Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, special occasion, we have a special guest. Who have you got lined up for us this week, Jem?
We have got Anna, who is a jack of all trades. She is a reenactor, she is an editor, she is a writer, she is a suggester and fan of Condensed History Gems 2, and also a mother of many small things. Anna, hello!
Hello! And how are you?
I'm good.
I'm still suffering from the plague here, so, you know, it's dragging on this. But let's not get into that again. So, Jem's kind of given us an overview of what you do. If you had to describe what you do yourself, what would your basic description of what you do be?
A freelance editor come zookeeper, mostly.
I mean, Jem didn't even get zookeeper in his list.
I've got three boys under 10. So.
I was going to say, that'll be the children, and I can relate to that. Greg, who is yet to reproduce, has no idea.
Hey, I just got two guinea pigs. I'm in over my head already.
I'm a bit of a cat freak as well. I love my cats.
Cool, but we're not here to talk about cats or kids. We're here to talk about history. And you, once again, you came up with our music suggestion a couple of months ago. And now you said, we're going to lead to the fact that you have a book out. But before we do that, you came up with a really good idea of the reappropriation of myths by other cultures. And I've got a few thoughts on that. But so what are your thoughts, Anna? What do you want to say about that?
Well, it's more the point that mythology, even going back as far as Homer and Hesiod, it has an impact on even our culture today. I mean, how many, even delivery companies are named after Greek gods. It's fed right through. And the thing is, it's not just for appropriation, for making money. My main focus today will be looking at myth has influenced what happens when myth is used to consolidate dynastic or political power, because myth is a big subject. It's actually big enough for the Open University to have a whole module on the subject, which was my last module for my OU degree that I finished in 2016. Oh, my goodness, it's been 2 years.
Yeah, yes, it does creep up on you, that, doesn't it?
When did that happen?
So, yeah, you're quite right. I did a Fast Five about the fact that when you think about it, this is, in theory, a Christian society, and yet all the days of the week are named after pagan gods, and we don't even bat an eyelid about it. You know, yes, you're quite right. Around us right now, I mean, movies, big movies that are coming out this year, last year, we got Thor, who is now a superhero and yet was genuinely somebody who was prayed to 1,000 years ago in Scandinavia. You've got Anthony Hopkins playing Odin, and then he's named after Wednesday. So I find that really interesting. And I'm just going to jump in there and tell you a little annoying story that I have. This misappropriation or reappropriation, sometimes it's interesting, sometimes it's benign, but I would say that there's this sort of quest to find exotic things. The world around us right now almost isn't good enough in a way. And there is a member of my family who is very spiritual and very much into their Eastern spiritualism. And I'm not going to sort of say too much because I don't want to give away who it is. But they were talking to me and saying how, they very much admire and follow the philosophies and spirituality and spiritual structure of Hinduism, Sikhism, and a little bit of Buddhism as well. And they said to me, you know, they're all basically the same thing. At which point I really had to sort of bite my tongue saying, idiot, do you know how many wars have been fought between those groups? You know, the ethnic violence between particularly Sikhs and Hindus, they do not consider themselves all at one with the spiritual world or anything like that. It's a classic example of a Westerner pick and mixing little bits and bobs of other people's very strongly held culture and say, oh, that's now mine. You know, I've reappropriated it. It's mine now. And my one last point of that is all the Buddhists in the West going, oh, Buddhism, it's so much better than all the other religions. You know that there's no war ever been declared in the name of Buddhism. No, but did you know that into the...
What's going on in Tibet right now, right?
Well, what?
They do know what's going on in Tibet and Burma.
Exactly. And you know, it was, you know, into the 19th century, it was a crime for thievery to be skinned alive in Tibet. You know, well, that's real peace and love. But my all-time favourite one is my all-time, and this is my last bit on this rant, is the fact that if you look at strict Buddhism, they say there's two things that cannot reach enlightenment. Animals, because they've yet to become humans. Okay, fair enough. And women, because they're not men yet. And that bit is very much forgotten about in the West because it doesn't play too well to Westerners. So yeah, you can't pick and mix something like that, but I say you can't, it happens, but I think you're going to miss some of the stuff in the first place. That's my little rant over with, but you're talking about older gods, aren't you?
Before we get back to the older gods, I'm going to just do a quick point and counterpoint, and I do apologise, Anna, you've listened to the podcast, you know we can't stick to it.
But I would probably die of shock if you ever did.
I'm just going to kind of take this in a slightly different way, because what you're talking about, Jem, there is a real established culture, then being appropriated by an entirely different culture. However, what we get with Greek myths is this is something that's fed over time. And I've been working recently on a story. It's going to be an audio book. It's a comedy story. The rest of that makes absolutely no sense at this point in time. However, for part of it, I wanted to include just briefly a reference to Professor Challenger, the character created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle alongside Sherlock Holmes. And I kind of wanted to have him just pop up for one tiny little scene in this story. And so I had to go out and try and find out what the rules were for me using this character. And actually, I found out that was pretty much fine. But there was a huge controversy about Sherlock Holmes. And it's actually gone to court multiple times about whether or not you can actually use Sherlock Holmes in your own story. And basically, where it stands at the moment is the very first Sherlock Holmes book, A Study in Scarlet, is out of copyright, which means you can use Sherlock Holmes in your story, but the last couple of Sherlock Holmes books are not yet entirely out of copyright and public domain, which means you're not allowed to refer to any facts about Sherlock Holmes' life that we learn in the later books. You're only allowed to use the ones we learn. And for me, this is where cultural misappropriation starts, and especially when we're talking about the Greek myths and we're going to be tracing it back, just to give a modern idea, Sherlock Holmes has kind of got into our culture, that is in our society, and there's kind of this feeling that we all kind of own a little bit of Sherlock Holmes. It's become bigger than just this one person's stories, and so he appears in all sorts of different places.
Now, sorry, go on, Greg.
A part of a literary conversation.
Yeah, and the thing is that with the Doyle estate, they're saying, well, what we don't want is we don't want everybody using Sherlock Holmes in their own way, because that will water down the essential meaning of what Sherlock Holmes was in Doyle's book. We want it just to be that story, the original story. And that's like saying, we don't want the myths to evolve, we don't want the myths to expand, we don't want them to be used by other people, we just want them to stay in place. That was my half of the rant, so now, Anna, pick apart what me and Jem have just said and see if you can make some sense out of something in there.
You're looking at a very, very modern context, but the thing is, myth has always evolved. I mean, look at Rome, for instance. You've just been to Italy.
Yes.
So you'll understand the Roman myth is a kind of meshing between Greek, Etruscan, and some very old and very obscure Mesopotamian myths. It's kind of a conglomeration because that's how the Roman Empire worked. It went around the world and picked the bits it liked and said, right, that's ours now. So you've essentially been Romanized. And it becomes very much how the British ruled their empire. They picked the bits they liked and they spread their influence throughout the Commonwealth and much of Africa. But the thing is, myth with the Romans was very akin to political power. Look, I mean, for instance, you've got Augustus, who was seen after his death, almost, he was deified, and seen as a sort of new Romulus because of his part in rebuilding Rome after decades of civil war. In, for instance, his shrine, his temple to Apollo that was built in the Forum, a lot of the imagery there was akin to the myth of Niobe and the Danaids, as a sort of sideways elbow nudge reference to Cleopatra and her arrogance, which actually eventually led to her downfall. I don't know if either of you guys know the myth of Niobe.
No, go on.
Okay. Niobe was a mythical creature, a high-born lady, and she was very, very proud of all her many, many children. And she took it upon herself, very silly, stupidly, might I add, to make fun of Leto. Leto was the mother of Artemis and Apollo. Guess who got upset? Well, Apollo, in the myth, went round and eventually killed all of Niobe's children, leaving her childless and without the standing that she felt so proud about. So if you think about that in terms of, in contrast with Cleopatra, she was very proud of who she was. She was a Ptolemy. She was the pharaoh of Egypt. She got there by her own strength. And what happened? She wouldn't admit to where her empire was falling, the weak points, and she eventually ended up killing herself rather than being taken captive by Octavius.
Now, it's a good story, and I love the parallel. But of course, you have an ulterior motive to have raised this, and this is why I'm going to bring it onto your book, which I've read about half of, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I would compare it to a little bit to American Gods. I think there's definitely a sort of bit of a Terry Pratchett vibe there as well. There's definitely a sense of humor. This is not a sort of full-blooded, po-faced story or anything like that. And it is to do with the gods sort of in the modern world, and the gods plural. So it's not just the Roman pantheon or Greek pantheon, is it?
It's all of them.
Because every last one of them. And you've picked... This is now my admission, okay? The hero of the story is the river man on the boat who carries the souls across the river Styx. And I can never work out how to say his name properly. So this is your chance to, A, settle that little dispute in my head to rest, and also tell us the name of the book.
You're not going to like this. It's actually disputed because it depends on the spelling. Sometimes it's spelled with a H, where it would be Charon, and sometimes it's spelled with a K, where it would be Charon.
Right, okay. So the jury's still out, but you've gone for Charon, yes?
I've gone for Charon because that is the most commonly regarded. That's the one people identify with because that's the more Romanized version. The K is the Greek, which is far earlier.
So tell us a little bit about the book. What's it called? Where can you get it? This is your chance to sort of do a little bit of a plug, but also bring in the mythology as well.
Well, the book is called Charon Unguarded, and it's an examination of what might have happened had the gods all been real. Because if you're going to believe in one, logically, you must believe in all of them, because they are equally likely or unlikely if you're like me and godless. But it's not, rather than looking at the myths and seeing doing a retelling, because a lot of people are doing retellings, I wanted to examine how they would have adjusted in a modern setting, how their lives would have moved on and how they would have coped. Mostly. And it's just a sort of tongue-in-cheek poking fun about what happens when important people try to ignore big issues and hope they go away.
And what was the starting point? What was the inspiration for this? Because obviously I've written some books as well. They're either history or historical fiction. So in a way, you could argue I'm cheating. I've already got the basic framework wherever I go. But when you're talking about a purely fantastical idea, how did that pop into your head, and how did you develop it?
I've had this actually rattling around in my head for about 10 years, and I decided to do the NaNoWriMo back in 2016 in November, because I'd finished my OU degree and I was trying to find ways to occupy my time while the kids were at school. And I just thought, okay, well, I'll develop this story, and it sort of, what is the most ridiculous scenario that I can think up? Oh, yes, a drunken bet, that will do. And just sort of see how it goes from there. But it was a lot of fun to write. And I actually have two more books in outline. So
yes, because you said it's a part of a trilogy, isn't it?
Yeah. It's unlikely to get bigger than the trilogy, but I do have a prequel on the go which deals with how they actually got here. Because I had so much background information, I thought that actually that would make quite a good book on its own. The book currently is available from my website in paperback format and on Amazon. And it's also on KDU. So if either of you have a Kindle Unlimited subscription, that will be available to you to read for free.
Yes, I've done that with Silent Crossroads as well. It's a good way to get your name out there. And how long did it take you to, because I know I'm kind of asking you how long is a piece of string, because there's all the editing and so on and so forth, but to break the back of it, to write out pretty much the first draft.
I was writing from November to the end of May. So let's just say I didn't make the NaNoWriMo target. It's mostly because I had to juggle between what I do for my job, which is the freelance editing. So I was editing everybody else's, bringing up three kids and trying to write my own. And something I was like, no, I do need to sleep sometimes.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being late. One of my favourite quotes, author quotes of all time, is Douglas Adams' quote, which was, I do love deadlines. I love the whooshing sound they make as they go flying past.
So I do like that one.
Nothing wrong with skimming. But actually, I've noticed, because I'm going to try and bring us back to the subject vaguely of appropriation of myths, but also kind of keeping in mind the books, because it's occurred to me that we've actually got three different types of appropriation being used in our three different books, because the book that I've been working on recently, I was asked by a steampunk newspaper to write a column, and the column I started writing has expanded into a story, and I call it The Slightly Exaggerated Tales of Greg Chapman. And what I'm doing is I'm writing a fictional story, a very silly fictional story, but it uses a lot of real life characters from within the steampunk scene. And when I'm using real people who are alive today and are friends of mine, obviously I have to go to each one and show them what I'm writing about and let them know what I'm going to write. Jem recently wrote Silent Crossroads, where you use Jem, sort of a real historical setting and real historical characters within that book, whereas Anna, you've taken myths, cultural myths, and you've used those as the basis for your book. And I was just thinking, which one of those have you got to deal with more sensitively? Historical figures, where you're dealing with real historical facts, mythology, where obviously there's a lot of, sort of belief and emotion built up with mythology, or if you're dealing with real people who are alive today and you know personally. And I wonder what were your thoughts on that, both of you, about which one of those you really need to be most careful with and most, which one you have to pay most respect to your source material, as it were.
Anna, what's your thoughts?
I would say if you are dealing with real people and real events of the past, it's so important not to muddy the facts. I mean, Bernard Cornwell, in his Uxred series, I'm getting back onto Vikings, Greg, can't help it. Bernard Cornwell on his Uxred series, he does what I did, which is look at minor characters as his primary protagonist. Arthur, King Alfred, is not the protagonist of the Uhtred series. The character is the protagonist, this Saxon who was brought up as a Viking. If you haven't read Bernard Cornwell's Uhtred series, really do. It's fantastic. I love it.
These are the ones that were adapted for BBC as Last Kingdom, is that right?
Yes, yeah, and yeah. They got it wrong, because Uhtred in that series is far too pretty. He is. He's not the character I imagined. You, in the books, he's a great big bear of a man with a face that looks like it's been lived in for a few decades. Not this skinny, pretty boy that I could knock over in a shield wall. I really could.
Well, that's TV for you, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think the general rule is, if you're talking about somebody who existed, you can kind of, in terms of legalities, you can kind of do what you want with them, except talk about infidelity, because that would have an impact on the family today. So, you know, if you wanted to make somebody a drunk, even though they weren't a drunk, you can do that. But I think if you're going to be respectful to your source material, you should try and keep it as close to the human being that you can get. And yeah, look, I went the same route with my stuff. You know, we're talking about the events from World War One to World War Two. You kind of know what's going to happen. You know what's basically going to happen. So therefore, you pick characters who don't exist, or, you know, are very minor, because you don't know what's going to happen to them. And as we said in our TV episode one, the problem I always have when you're basically picking a key person in history, like Henry VIII, you know he's going to end up with six wives. So it's more interesting if you get somebody in the court of Henry VIII. Maybe you make this person up, so you've got real events happening in the background, but I don't know what's going to happen to this guy. You know, is he going to get married? Is he going to die in battle? You just don't know.
Yeah, and that's the other thing with historical fiction. You can't change the event, the outcomes of major events, like battles. You're sort of stuck within... You've almost got your outline laid out for you already, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yes. As I said earlier, you know, it's almost like cheating. You've got the framework of the story already there. But in terms of your point there, Greg...
I don't think it is cheating, because in a way you've got stricter rules that you have to stick to in order to get your story across. Whereas I could just say, right, I've got the gods in a modern setting. What am I going to do with them? Dance, my pretties. You're my puppet. You know, I could pretty much do whatever I wanted to them, so long as I kept the characters of these gods as true as I could to how they were depicted in the old myths. But I didn't want to make it about the old myths. This was moving on. That was their back, all their old myths. That's the backstory. That is a load of info dumping that I don't want to add in, because that's an editing nightmare.
Now, yeah, but picking up on your other point, Greg, if you are going to talk about, you know, religions, all you have to do is look at something like the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. If you're picking something that's a big, you know, a heartfelt religion today, you have to be super careful about what you do. But yeah, I think one of the advantages, Anna, of what you've done is, you know, there are, I'm sure, a few people out there who still believe in these gods, but they are very, very, very much in the minority. You know, these are now myths and legends, and if people get annoyed at what you've done with, let's say, Ares or whatever, not that many people are going to get annoyed about it. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, again, Sharon, and you're certainly not going to get blown up about it. You know?
Yeah. The amount of militant ancient Greek believers is minimal.
And also, your advantage, if you're taking a myth and, you know, bringing the characters into the modern day, your advantage there is you're not... Because you say people aren't going to get militant. I noticed there's a new series just started about the Trojan War. I've not watched it yet on the BBC. But I imagine people will watch that and go, oh, well, that's not right in the myth. That's not right in the myth. This happened. I know when... the Brad Pitt film about Troy came out, people very quickly went up in arms that, no, the war's supposed to be 9 years long and it only lasted 3 months. And you think, well, yes, but in that particular version of the myth. And so you would have, if you were trying to retell the myths, I'm sure there would be people that go, oh, no, I prefer this. But when you're dealing with it as bringing it up to the modern day, you can sort of say, well, yeah, what you heard as a myth is a myth, but I'm dealing, you know, with the future of these characters based on what actually happened, as it were, in the past, in with big quotation marks.
Yeah, the other thing you need to remember is when Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, he, at the time, was doing what I'm doing. He was looking at much older myths and putting them in a narrative city for dramatic effect. He was, I mean, they've been dated to the 8th century BCE, but they've dated much earlier. I mean, Dionysus is older than one of the oldest Greek gods. Apparently, he was from about 12th century BCE. Mesopotamia, there have been Dionysus-type figures around that long. So it's kind of a old book in a new jacket, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I like that.
Yes, and of course, go on. Yeah, and, you know, just sort of to touching on the world of Christianity, Christianity itself has reappropriated old myths. Why do we have Christmas round about December 25th? On December 25th, there's no mention of dates or anything like that in the Bible because it's the winter solstice. It was a hugely popular celebration in the world, and therefore, if you can't beat them, join them, and we'll just rebrand it. Quite often, the images of God is an old man with a beard, which is a little bit like Odin, a little bit like Zeus. You know, again, he's not mentioned to look like that in the Bible, but it's just reappropriating these other ideas of power or spirituality or gods or whatever you want to call them, and making it fit your version of events. I've recently, just a few days ago, I was in Bath, and, you know, even there, it's showing you how, as soon as you've got a pantheon of gods, you can turn up to a new place and people go, oh, we pray to X. And you go, oh, that's a little bit like our god, and it's absolutely fine. You call it X, we call it Y. We're fine with that because we got loads of gods. It's actually once you only have one supreme being, you get a bit prickly about what people are calling their local gods and exactly what that local god's meant to do in terms of powers.
Yeah, and but according to the Bible, he doesn't need his followers to get prickly. He can do that all by himself.
Yeah, very much so. For further information, there's this thing called the Old Testament. We are, of course, heading towards the end of things, aren't we, guys? As always, we sort of run out of time on these things. But, you know, you've talked about the book. How long's it been out? And also, can you tease at all when potentially the second one might come out?
I am aiming to get the second one.
But before you say anything else, let me tell you that if you tell Jem when your second book's coming out and you leave it 3 years late, he will have a go. Just so you know, I'm just warning you now. I told him when my next book was going to come out. Still isn't out. He will mention it again. So just give yourself a bit of padding when you give us the date, whatever you do.
I'm thinking around November, December time. So it's out for the Christmas month.
And Greg, because she's an editor, she knows what a deadline is.
Yeah. Also, the good thing is she was very clever there. She didn't give a year. That was very clever. I did notice that.
Yeah, could be this year.
I respect that.
No, I do intend to get that one finished. It'll be about the same length. So I've got a prequel teaser in the current book. So you'll be able to read the first chapter of what I'm working on at the moment at the end.
Fantastic. So just remind us of your website address again where people can pick up a copy of the book.
My website is www.ahjohnstone.com, and that's there's a store online, or you can go to Amazon, and I'll give you the link for that so you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that's fine. Send that across. That'll go down in the notes below. And I think, Jem, we are just about out of time. Did either of you have any last thing to say before we wrap this thing up?
No, thank you. I'm fine.
I would just like to say thank you very much, Anna, for joining us, sharing with us your ideas and your views of writing and also mythology, and also putting up with Greg's cough. Greg, we feel for you, darling.
Oh.
Thank you, Jem. The good news is, Jem, that nobody listening is going to know what you're talking about, because I will edit out the cough before we get there. So I'll have to leave one in now, just so you know that. So massive, massive thank you to you, Anna. It really is great. It's really great to have listeners coming on as guests. We have some guests come on the show that, you know, sort of haven't listened to the podcast before. But when we get the guests come on who listen to the show, who know what the show is about, it really is good fun, because you came on well prepared for the fact that we were probably never ever going to get to the topic that we were started out with. And that is kind of what we make the show about. So thank you so much for not just for coming on now, but also for your suggestions and all of your support on Twitter for the podcast over time.
You're welcome.
And of course, a massive, massive thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Baduki.
And a wonderful thank you and get well soon to my co-host, Greg Chapman.
And that's all for us for this week. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you once again to Anna. And for now, goodbye. And take care.